From Michigan Radio, this is Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. Today, we look at Michigan's growing permaculture movement.
What we're really talking about here is that the old models and the old systems of infinite growth on a finite planet aren't really working out for us anymore.
We'll look at seasonal affective disorder.
You know, we all suffer through winter, don't we? Why do some people suffer worse than others?
What happened when a young man from Dearborn followed his heart across the ocean to Ukraine for a girl he'd only met for 20 minutes?
My parents and my closest friends thought I was a little crazy, and they were probably right, but at the time, it just, you know, why not?
And ski jumpers heading to the UP, soaring through the air in September.
Athletes are on a plastic track that is like a water slide.
Those stories and much more today on Stateside. How do we keep guns out of the wrong hands? That's the question behind the Identi-Lock.
An authorized fingerprint can literally press a button and the lock falls off the gun.
I'm Cynthia Canty. Today on Stateside, we'll hear about a smart gun lock that uses fingerprint identification to ensure that only the owner is able to use that gun. But first, if you do an internet search for Great Lakes permaculture or Midwest permaculture, you'll soon discover this is a thriving movement in Michigan. Nate Ayers is with us now. He's founder and director of Chiwara Permaculture in Ann Arbor. Let's get very, very basic, Nate. Just what is permaculture design?
Permaculture is an ecological design science. It's a pedagogy that consists of principles and ethics. But really, at the foundation of permaculture, it's about creating a lens that we can use to interact with and produce very sustainable and resilient environments. At its core, permaculture is about designing sustainable food systems. When it was first started in the 1970s by a couple of Australians, it was short for permanent agriculture. Mm. These Australians were realizing that the way that we were growing food was not going to be very sustainable into the future because of what we're doing to biodiversity, old growth forests, and what's happening to our soil quality. So they spent a lot of time studying ecology, spent a lot of time observing. And they came up with this system of encountering nature and designing patterns and systems that really mimic nature's brilliance. And one of the benefits of these brilliance is to be able to produce abundant food, renewable energy, as well as sort of a lot of the staples that we associate with modern society, whether it's medicine, fibers, fuels, things like that.
So it's really gone from an idea of how to conduct agriculture to a whole life mindset.
Yeah, that's the beauty of this lens, what I sort of refer to as a nature-based systems thinking lens, is that we can pull all of these lessons from nature, from the woods or the forest or a place like that, and see how nature is really a closed-loop system. There's no such thing as garbage in nature. There's no waste produced. Nature recycles everything. So we can take these lessons and these observations from nature and apply it to just about every other field of human endeavor.
Now, you have had a pretty interesting personal journey from being in a funk band to founding and directing your permaculture design team. Tell us how that happened.
I got interested in sustainability when I was in college at Indiana University. And while I was there, if you remember the year 2000, Y2K bug, I got a little spooked about what was happening in the world and afraid that, you know, the computers were going to crash and all this associated mayhem.
The wheels were going to come off the wagon.
That's right. So I got really interested in self-sufficiency and sustainability, in nature awareness and really how to thrive in nature without defeating it. So I was a musician at the time, playing professionally in a bunch of different bands. Had this interest of sustainability starting to emerge, though. Got really interested in solar power, solar photovoltaics, received some training for that. And after college, moved back to Ann Arbor, was in a pretty popular band called the Third Coast Kings, and they're still around. And had some success doing that, but really started to realize it wasn't as fulfilling as I hoped for, and sort of started to realize that the promise of the entertainment industry wasn't as fulfilling as maybe some have led others to believe. So got a bit disillusioned with all that and ended up stepping aside from the band and really starting to pursue permaculture full time as a result of going out to California and taking my permaculture design certification in 2009. And so after doing that, came back to Michigan and was just, this is what I want to do with my life. So stopped playing in the band and started my own company, and it's been a bit of a journey ever since.
And you really have, you've converted your home, you started teaching classes out of your home, using it for research and development for the classes. What goes into converting a house to permaculture?
couple big questions came up for me when I really decided to go gung-ho into permaculture. The first one being, how do we get the modern American house off of fossil fuels? In a couple different areas, food, energy, water, building, transportation, and waste. I started to look at my house in Ann Arbor really like an R&D lab and started growing as much food as possible anywhere where it would grow, in the backyard, front yard, side yard. Started doing some things with the water utilities in our house to be able to align things. A lot of talk about gray water systems and recycling water throughout a home. But looking at renewables, of course, energy audits and things like that that help us use less energy so that we can start to have a successful dialogue about solar power and wind power and things like that. But really looked at my house like a living, learning laboratory. And I was really fortunate to get involved with Washtenaw Community College on the front end of my teaching career, and they actually let me teach classes at my house through Washtenaw Community College. So every month would have a couple different classes, and we did these permaculture two-day intensives where about 15 people would come out to my house, and we would go over the permaculture principles and ethics. But then the biggest thing about permaculture is getting people hands-on experience. It really doesn't do it justice to learn about this stuff online or in a book. You have to get out there. You have to get in nature. You have to get your hands dirty.
So
that's what we started doing. Yep.
And you've partnered with schools in Detroit and Ann Arbor. So take us further into ways to kind of integrate permaculture into traditional learning.
What we're really talking about here is that the old models and the old systems of infinite growth on a finite planet aren't really working out for us anymore. And what I saw in permaculture essentially was a new operating system that was built on building regenerative systems. To me, it became really important to spread this message, and I would talk about it with anybody that would listen. But I was fortunate enough to, you know, have a little bit of a background in education coming from college, in that I had friends who were teachers in Ann Arbor, and they allowed me to pilot a lot of this stuff in their K through 12 classrooms. Started developing some curriculum that utilized permaculture as a vehicle for STEM education, STEM, science, technology, engineering, and mathematics. And found a lot of success with schools that were having difficulty really engaging their students in this new way of thinking in practical ways. To come along with permaculture curriculum that got students outside, engaged with their natural environment, doing a lot of observation and data collection outside of the classroom, but ultimately focused on solutions, became a really powerful driver in my life. And when we talk about, you know, designing systems for long-term sustainability, engineers have this concept of leverage points. And a leverage point is where we can intervene in a system to have the greatest effect. And I see education as being one of those leverage points where if we can design, you know, curriculum and pedagogies that get kids involved in good community-based solutions and solving community problems, that's really, really worthwhile. And so that's what we were able to have some success with early on with our permaculture curriculum.
And you're also partnering with the University of Michigan. And what are you working on there?
I started partnering with the University of Michigan in 2012. I was brought in by the Graham Institute of Sustainable Studies to do a research course, essentially trying to figure out where does permaculture fit at an institution like the University of Michigan. So they gave me a couple of interns, got them skilled up in permaculture design systems and this lens I keep talking about.
Yeah.
And we started to ask the question, you know, where does this idea fit at the University of Michigan? Is it engineering? Is it design? Is it the School of Natural Resources and Environment? And what we ultimately found was, yes, all of it. But it took us a couple different semesters of really refining our approach about what kind of pedagogy is this, what students will this apply to. And so over the course of the last 3 years, we've done some grant writing. We've done some more classes. I continue to do research projects with U of M. And a lot of it culminated this past year when we got some grant funding to install a 3-acre sustainable food forest at Matai Botanical Gardens. So there's a University of Michigan permaculture design team, which I'm the advisor for, and they're in charge of maintaining and really teaching from this new permaculture installation at the Botanical Gardens. It's really caught a pretty fast edge at the university, and there seems to be a lot of enthusiasm for it now.
You are planting seeds in young minds from, as you say, from K through 12, and then now on through community college, through the University of Michigan. What rewards do you believe will reap from this growing awareness and understanding of permaculture, especially as these youngsters move up and become the decision makers?
Well, it's my hope that ultimately we can get to a place where every decision that's made takes into account what is our impact on nature. And we're fortunate that a lot of smart people are starting to think about this now and what we could call ecosystem services or green infrastructure, which is really asking the question, what is the value that nature provides for us? We don't often think about a forest as providing thousands and thousands of dollars in terms of air purification or water conservation and things like that. But utilizing a permaculture lens to be able to look at the value that nature provides for us, I think will ultimately train people to see that we have to figure out ways to reintegrate humanity with nature. We've been operating for quite some time thinking that we're separate from nature, and what we're ultimately finding is that we are extremely interconnected with nature. So it's really my hope that by getting this type of systems thinking out in front of people, we can change the minds of lots of folks that are going to grow up and make decisions that impact all of us.
What are the biggest challenges you think you face in trying to make this our default way of thinking, the idea of not being separate from nature?
I think that we're currently stuck in a lot of patterns right now on planet Earth.
Old patterns.
Yeah, old patterns. We've got systems of doing business that are really based on growth year after year after year. It's like we don't have a sustainable company unless we're growing. And what we're realizing is that that's actually the opposite of sustainability. What we want to do is to be able to almost draw a circle around ourselves and say, can we produce everything that we need within this local economy? Can we supply all of our needs for food, energy, building, transportation, and waste within our immediate community? And can we do that in ways that empower people to take responsibility for themselves? You know, as we're seeing so much upheaval and change in the world right now, this new generation of younger kids and millennials are sort of not buying the old story and really interested in trying new ways of relating to planet Earth. And I think that's something that permaculture, why it's so popular with a new generation of younger people is because it resonates with them that this feels right. We need to take into account our impact on the Earth. The biggest challenge we're really seeing is just almost bringing down the old guard to be able to demonstrate that this is the way forward and we only have one planet to make these choices on.
Nate Ayers, founder and director of Chiwara Permaculture Research and Education in Ann Arbor. Thank you very, very much for sharing your work with us.
Thank you. It's been my pleasure.
And we always want to hear from you. What stories are you focusing on or people that you want to hear more about? Just let us know. It's very easy. You can find us on Facebook. Search for Stateside with Cynthia Canty. We're also on Twitter at Stateside Radio. And as always, MichiganRadio.org. And click the link that says Stateside. This is Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. One of the great gifts of life is surprises. How could R.J. Fox know that going on the E.T. ride in Hollywood would lead him to the woman he'd want to marry? And from there, in the name of love, on to her home country, Ukraine. And that is where R.J. was surprised by scowling old babushka-wearing ladies, a farmer who nearly beat him up for trying to photograph his goat, future in-laws he was hoping to impress, and vodka. Lots and lots of vodka. R.J. Fox tells quite a story in his new memoir, Love and Vodka, My Surreal Adventures in Ukraine. R.J., good to have you on Stateside.
Thank you for having me.
One might also subtitle your book, How Did a Kid from Dearborn, Michigan Wind Up Being Frog Marched Around a Farmyard in Ukraine Trying to Work Off the Hellacious Effects of Too Many Vodka Toasts?
That is a great question that I ask myself every day, looking back, you know, 15 years later. Basically in March of 2000, I headed out to Hollywood to attend some screenwriting workshops and went to Universal Studios on a cold, rainy day in Hollywood and kind of wandering around by myself, and I spotted this attractive girl, which, you know, typically for me, you know, I spot somebody that's attractive and just keep on walking because I, you know, I have no game, as I call it. So a little bit later, I saw her again, and she was getting onto the E.T. ride. She was eating peanut M&Ms, and I was eating peanut M&Ms, and it felt so fateful. So I follow her on, and I know that sounds kind of creepy because it kind of is looking back, but we ended up sitting next to each other, and nobody else was on the ride. We just rode this ride together and spoke for a few minutes and got off the ride, and I walked her back to the gate because it was time for her to go. So we had about a 20-minute conversation, just small talk, and you know, it turned out she was from Ukraine, and I was from Dearborn, but she was living in Mississippi as an exchange student and somehow was in California, and this whole thing was all happening. So she went back to Ukraine a few months later. Obviously, I went back home to Michigan, and we became pen pals. And then a year later, I decided on a whim to propose to her by taking a ring with me and heading over to Ukraine halfway around the world.
Now, so that must have been some pen pal relationship.
Yeah. I mean, at first it was just, you know, run-of-the-mill pen pal, you know, back and forth through email and through chat. And then, you know, I'm like, oh, this this person kind of gets me, and that's a rarity, I think. And so, yeah, and I was, you know, I was 23, I think, at the time, and it just seemed like the right thing to do. And my parents and my closest friends thought I was a little crazy, and they were probably right. But at the time, it just, you know, why not?
Now, what did you know about Ukraine before getting on that plane and heading over there?
You know, I knew it was like Russia in many ways. You know, you think of the Soviet Union, Russia, and in many ways, especially where she was from, it very much is Russian in culture in eastern Ukraine. So I didn't know a whole lot. It was very superficial. In fact, at the time, and if you look at the cover of the book, you see the crossed off in front of Ukraine because many people still refer to it as the Ukraine, and it's Ukraine. So I learned that early on. But, yeah, I didn't really know much. And I obviously, as the book is a testament to, learned a lot of my little adventure there.
You know, those early impressions and even through the rest of your trip show us a pretty intimidating place. Could you read us a bit from your book? And this is, I guess, as you arrived in Ukraine. This is your very, very early
Correct.
Impressions.
Yeah, it's actually sitting in the waiting room at in Frankfurt where I had a layover, and all the passengers waiting there with me were Ukrainian, and here was me, the sole American. So I'm sitting there, and I'll begin right here. I managed to find a seat between two middle-aged men who either apparently had never heard of deodorant or simply ran out a long time ago. They both glared at me as though I had just announced that I had slept with their mothers. I took the ring case out of my pocket and examined it for the 100th time. From the corner of my eye, I felt someone, something, staring at me from across the aisle. I looked up. It was an old Ukrainian babushka woman, carrying a cage containing a chicken. This image begged the requisite questions. Why a chicken? Did you come here just to get this chicken? Was it for her? Was it a present, a pet, a future dinner? All the above? As I continued staring at her chicken, I realized she was staring at me, more specifically, glaring at me. Was I being cursed? But what had I done? Is staring at someone's chicken a crime in Ukraine? Unable to come up with the answers I so desperately craved, I simply stared down at the ring, but I could feel the woman's glare intensify. But why? Do old Ukrainian babushka women hate rings? Hate Americans? Hate Americans who carry rings? I figured that her glare would subside and that she would return to minding her own business. But each time I looked up, there she was, glaring, as if to say, come on, just try it. I could take you down any day. I put the ring case back in my pocket. She continued to glare. Thankfully, my imminent curse was curtailed by a loud announcement. It was time to board.
That's R.J. Fox reading from his memoir, Love and Vodka, My Surreal Adventures in Ukraine. And I have to say, I don't think you met a babushka who didn't hate you on the spot the whole time you were there.
Yeah.
Do you think you represented, you know, the Cold War and, for them, memories of World War II as well?
I think that's a lot of it. A general distrust of foreigners, people who aren't from there. There's definitely a lot of that in public, not just with the old babushka women, but, you know, just in general when you're out in public. However, it's such a contrast to when you're inside their apartments and the hospitality, when you're with a family and with friends that, you know, that have invited you into their home. But if you're not invited, they make it clear that you're not invited, just the glares and so on. So,
and it was stunning how you would go up to a vendor of any kind and want to spend money, and they would act as if, oh, really? You're wrecking my day here.
Yeah.
surly attitude.
I always got the sense that I was inconveniencing everybody, even people that I was trying to buy something from. And many times, you know, I was always told, one of the things I was always told was, don't speak English, because, you know, the perception is if you're English speaking or particularly American, you have tons of money and they're going to take advantage of that. So there was many times I was told don't speak, which is probably good advice for me in many ways, but but over there for sure.
Well, here you are. You're trying to cope with a totally new world. You're not speaking your language, the language there. You're getting things wrong everywhere you turn. You're making new friends all over the place. And you're trying to make a good impression on Katya's family. Tell us about them. Start with Dad, because he's a
okay.
character.
Sergei, who the father in the book, is kind of the prototypical Cold War era gentleman. He worked in academia. Mm-hmm. He was part of the party back in the old days, and very strict, very rigid, but also very, very passionate, particularly when it comes time to do the toasts and the vodka that goes with that. Very eloquent, very poetic, and very just happy and celebratory about life. But then he always just sort of had this gruff sort of presence outside of that sort of environment. So
his bark was worse than his bite?
Yes. And maybe in the book he's, I wouldn't say one-dimensional, but, you know, I feel like maybe I focus more on the stern side of him, because I was, the future prospective spouse for his daughter, and I think, you know, he was being protective like any father. But
honestly, I disagree with you. I got a sense of a real sweetheart under that gruffness. He did not come off one dimensional.
Well, that's good, because I tried to put that extra dimension in there, so I'm glad it comes through.
It does.
You know, because I was trying not, you know, because ultimately, even when you're writing nonfiction, eventually the characters kind of do take on a life of their own, because you have the real story in your head that you're being true to, but then also they become just characters like they are in fiction. You know, they're characters in your mind, and you're sculpting them and bringing them to life and trying to be fair to their true selves and their inner motivations and all that. And also always knowing that, hey, these are real people. I have to be true to what actually happened. So
let's talk about the aftermath.
Okay.
You come home, you bring her with you, you get married, but it didn't last.
It did not last. It lasted for 8 years. And, you know, and I don't, looking back, I have no regrets. The marriage just didn't last the way you would hope any marriage would.
Mm-hmm.
But there's a happy ending, because I ended up getting remarried, have two beautiful kids with my wife Ellen, and Katya, the real Katya, got married as well. And she's doing very well, still living here in Michigan. And so, yeah, so we both found, you know, new lives and happier lives, I suppose. And, you know, and the 8 years were overall a happy time. But, you know, just like with any marriage that ends, there are reasons. And, you know, we had some great times and great memories. And, you know, we're talking about 15 years from when I experienced the trip. And most of the book contains, you know, the 2 week period from when I was there on that first initial trip. And I do that second trip at the end of the book. So it doesn't, you know, it ends with us leaving the airport together.
Yeah.
And then, you know, I do wonder, our readers going to, in their mind, assume that we lived happily ever after. And, you know, and I like to think the characters in the book do, just not in real life, I suppose. That's usually how it goes.
You had a lot of adventures. And you do hope to make this a screenplay and get it made?
Yeah. Well, in fact, it first was a screenplay. When I came back from the trip in 2001, I started writing the script version. Because actually my initial background is in screenwriting.
Yeah.
And that has always been my dream since high school, to be a screenwriter. So I wrote the script. I optioned it to a producer. And, you know, it looked like, wow, it's finally happening. And we went through tons of development, and the script was becoming less and less true story and more sort of Hollywoodized.
Which many writers will say they've seen happen.
And this, you know, overall, I felt the changes were, I wasn't 100% upset with the changes, but, you know, I just had to accept that, okay, this is not quite the true story that it should be. But then when there was talk of maybe changing the setting to Asia, that's when I'm like, wait, what? Wait, this is Ukraine, this is Asia. This, you know, so that...
There's a surreal adventure for you right there, trying to get my book turned into a movie.
In hindsight, I'm glad, you know, the option expired and the producer was unable to get it off the ground for various reasons. So I was dejected, but also I looked at it as a new opportunity, decided to turn the book or the script into the book that it now is. So now my goal is to bring it back full circle into the realm of film, to go back to Hollywood, which is where the book literally starts out.
The book is Love and Vodka, My Surreal Adventures in Ukraine, a love story fueled by vodka toast he couldn't escape, babushkas who despised him, and a young woman named Katya who made it all worthwhile. R.J. Fox will be reading from his book and signing copies this Thursday night at Page's Bookshop right there in Northwest Detroit. And there are other events coming up. You can go to fowbooks.com, Fish Out of Water Books, fowbooks.com. R.J., thanks so much for sharing your story with us.
Thank you. It's been great.
All right, everyone. Where do you think the largest ski jumping structure in the world is located? Nope, not Bavaria, not Switzerland, not Scandinavia. It's Ironwood's Copper Peak in the Upper Peninsula at 469 feet, a place where ski jumpers, ski flyers, soar through the air at over 65 miles an hour. Copper Peak was built in 1970. The last ski flying competition happened there in 1994. But plans are afoot to renovate the ski jump for a contest in September 2017. Bob Jacquart is with us now. He's chair of the Copper Peak Organizing Committee. So good to have you with us, Bob.
Hello, Cindy. I'm happy to be here.
Now, the gap between 1994 and 2017, that's a pretty big gap. Why was there such a long hiatus between competitions?
Well, in 1994, the tournament was almost canceled or somewhat canceled, and it left them in a bad deficit. So they were in the hole, struggled to get out of it by selling tickets to the adventure ride. I think there might be some people in your listening audience that have probably been to the top of Copper Peak, paid $20, and taken a wonderful chairlift ride and then an elevator ride to the top. So they've been doing that. And the board members that have been volunteering for the last 20-plus years have basically been selling Copper Peak as an adventure ride, waiting for something, an opening or something to happen for them.
So this idea that there's actually going to be a Federation of International Skiing event coming in 2017 is a real boost.
Yes, it's a real boost to everybody. I mean, the world of ski jumping has become very large in Europe. It's the most watched winter sport in Europe right now. Hmm. Imagine, they don't have the NHL and they don't have the NFL and they don't have college hockey. And the big sports names in Europe are the ski jumpers now. And the World Cup circuit, which is the grand champions and the high elite athletes, they don't jump right now in the United States, ever.
So getting them over here is a big deal.
Yes, from both sides. It's a great deal for us, but it's a great deal for Europe. And so Europe is going to see Copper Peak in Ironwood, Michigan for the first time in a long time. And this is the first time that Copper Peak has had the World Cup athletes on the jump. Even though it's big and it's been grand and it's been around a long time, the World Cup circuit has never fully had a full meet on Copper Peak yet. And this will be the first one.
Give us a sense of the difference between ski jumping and then ski flying.
Okay. That's easy if you can just imagine distance. And the lip of the takeoff and down to the bottom of the hill is the measurement that's used to measure a ski jump. And in the Olympics, they jump 90 meters is called the normal hill, and 120 meters is called the large hill. And that's what they get gold medals and silver medals and bronze medals, two different events.
Okay.
90, 120, and Copper Peak is 180. It's monstrously bigger.
Mm. So ski flying is what, ski jumping on steroids?
Yes, it's actually when a ski jump distance surpasses 180 meters, it becomes ski flying.
Got it.
And there are only five, now six in the circuit, hills that surpass 180 meters.
What kind of renovations need to happen before Copper Peak is ready for these jumpers in 2017?
Well, the fun part about it is we're going to do it in the summertime. We're going to do it without snow. And to make that happen, first of all, the rules in FIS were that no ski flying hill shall be allowed to put, they call it plastic or an artificial surface on it. And in October, we were given the right to be the only ski flying hill in the world to have a summer surface on it. So that had to happen first. And then there's a plastic track that's put up on the takeoffs instead of a track made and packed in with snow for your skis to go in there. Athletes are on a plastic track that is like a water slide.
Huh.
There's water pouring on it, and they're in a little white plastic track. And the fun, exciting, daring part about it is they spray WD-40 on the bottom of their skis before they jump. That's their ski wax. And so basically they go down a water slide, but it gives them unbelievable consistency of speed. It's the same speed every time. Doesn't make a difference what the temperature is. There's no snow conditions to worry about. And then they land on artificial green-colored grass that doesn't stick up like grass does vertically. It's laying horizontally. It looks like an artificial grass roof on a hut in the tropics. It looks like a bunch of hula skirts laying down on top of, shingled up, and that's sprinkled and wet, and they land on that.
That explains why they can do this contest in September. Where's the money coming from to get all this done? How's it being paid for?
Well, we're at that point right now. We've done estimates. We've hired a large marketing company that's familiar with the Super Bowl and the Major League Baseball All-Star Game and the Men's Final Four, and there's a big fundraising campaign starting, and it's basically starting in Lansing, in the hub of our state. We believe that the cameras will be on Copper Peak, and they will be saying, "Welcome to Michigan." And we're hoping that there's some good, that not only can we do something great for our community and our region up here in the Upper Peninsula, but we can also bring that huge international audience to Michigan. And when they think about Michigan, you may know that as well as anybody. When you say you're from Michigan, nobody ever says, "Are you from Ironwood?" They always say, "Are you from Detroit or Lansing or Ann Arbor, or which football team do you cheer for?"
Mm.
There's never a reference to the Upper Peninsula. So we're going to hope to do that backwards, where when they do say Michigan, they do think about our great industrial site as well as the beautiful place the Upper Peninsula is.
Bob Jacquart is chair of the organizing committee of Copper Peak, getting it all ready for a new lease on life in time for a Federation of International Ski Jumping event in September of 2017. Well, we'll keep our ear to the ground and keep us posted on how the progress goes. And it, I'm sure September 2017 will be here before you know it, Bob.
Well, that's awesome. Thanks so much for reaching out to us. We really appreciate it.
This is Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty.
Creation.
Curiosity.
The next idea.
We weren't setting out to do these huge things. We were just starting with solving a problem we hoped a few other people had.
How do we keep guns out of the wrong hands? No matter where you stand on the gun issue, that's a question we can pretty much all agree on. And it's the question driving the Identilock. It's a smart gun lock using fingerprint identification to make sure that only the owner can use that gun. Detroit entrepreneur Omar Kiani is inventor of Identilock, and he is with us now. Welcome. Good to have you with us, Omar.
Thank you so much.
This is considered a smart gun lock. What does that mean exactly?
A smart gun lock is a technology that prevents unauthorized access. It's different than anything else out there in the market. There's nothing that allows you the mobility, the security, and the speed that Identilock gives you.
And how does it work?
An authorized fingerprint can literally press a button and the lock falls off the gun.
So the way that I open up my smartphone with my little thumbprint.
Exactly.
And so it fits on the gun. It's something you buy after you own your gun and fits on it.
So Identilock is simply a clamp that clasps the gun, preventing access to the trigger guard. Using your fingerprint, you literally press the button and it falls off the gun.
Who do you think your customer is?
My target audience are parents like myself who have young children and have guns in the house for home protection or shooting sports.
And otherwise, looking beyond?
Looking beyond, I believe any gun owner is a target audience, because if your firearm is used by an unauthorized manner, you're responsible. So anybody who owns a gun, this could be a very viable solution for them.
So what motivated you to come up with this idea and to perfect it?
So I myself am a victim of gun violence. But more importantly, I have spent majority of my career as an automotive safety engineer. I, as a profession, used to destroy prototype cars to make them safer. I'm a gun owner, and I have three young children. So I, of course, was motivated by solving my own problem, which led me to develop Identilock. Because I know how it is to be on the wrong side of the gun.
I cannot imagine.
You don't want to. Mm. So I absolutely, utterly believe Identilock will save lives. So that motivates me to wake up every morning, regardless of how tough it is, and go out and make progress.
And the idea of, as you say, with three small children, and, you know, Omar, you and I both know there's not a week goes by that we don't see from some part of the country, certainly right here in Southeast Michigan, some story of a youngster who gets his or her hands on a gun lying around the house and horrific things happen.
Right. And in your case, you're just reading that story. I have a technology that can save that life. So the stress level on me is obviously tremendously high, that every stone that I have to turn to make sure that I'm doing everything I can to launch this product.
Now, have you gotten any resistance to the Identilock? Any legal challenges? Any other kind of issues that have arisen?
Fortunately, nothing like that. The challenges remain in making sure the product is reliable, the product is secure, and it's tamper-proof. So, because the most curious individuals are the children. And we've done some amazing things to make this product tamper-proof. You can hit it with a hammer, it won't open multiple times.
Gun violence is something that, as a nation, certainly as a state, we have been so deeply troubled by this. And in this day of age, with the kind of conversations that we're having about gun rights and gun control, how do you think the Identilock fits into that discussion?
So I'm an entrepreneur. My focus is to solve a technical problem. And in this case, myself and plenty of my gun click members have a problem. That's what I'm trying to solve. So there is no magic wand. Even in a car, there's hundreds of systems trying to keep you safe. Identilock is one of those systems.
Do you think Mass shootings are a boon or a bust? Could they be for a product like yours, like this smart gun lock?
No comment.
Now, your company, Sentinel, is going to be based in Detroit. You're going to have the Identilock assembled in Detroit. Why was it important to you to do that, to have it be in Detroit?
So my son asked me, he's never seen anything that's made in USA. How come? And as an engineer, I understand that, you know, it's the manufacturing went outside the U.S. because it was cost effective. But that's not to say that it was less efficient to manufacture in the U.S. Anything that requires high level of assembly is what might be better off manufactured in China. But anything that's efficiently manufactured can be manufactured in the U.S., and actually it is. Detroit is a huge manufacturing hub, and I don't know of another place that has the engineering talent of electrical, software, material science, all available in one 30-mile radius, really cheap rent, and a skill that is competitive to anywhere else in the world.
How long have you been working on this?
I've been working on it now, I think, for 3 years. A big portion of that was I was doing it at night after my day job. And at the start of this year, I quit, and I've been working on this full time.
That is the pure entrepreneur story. And it does take a real leap of faith, doesn't it, to say, okay, I'm going to step away from that safety net of the day job, and I'm going to try to make this idea fly.
Yes, that is absolutely true. The stakes are a little bit higher in the kind of product that I'm working on because, you know, each day that's not out there, it's another life not saved. So that is definitely a different level. And then for me, I got it to a point where I knew that I can't do this with my day job. So I had to jump in the deep end.
All right. So what's next? What are your plans for the Identilock?
We're planning on launching Identilock in 2016. The goal is to launch it as soon as possible. So we're right now making our final tests, getting our manufacturing lined up, and getting it ready to ship.
Well, keep us posted. Good luck with this. It's certainly been clearly a passion of yours, and you really do – one gets a sense of the mission you feel in getting this product into the hands of gun owners. Amur Kayani is the inventor of the Identilock. It was good to have you with us on The Next Idea. Thank you so much.
Thank you so much for having me.
Support for The Next Idea on Stateside comes from Michigan Economic Development Corporation, committed to marketing Michigan to drive job growth and investment in our communities. MichiganBusiness.org.
We'll officially greet winter at 11:48 p.m. next Monday, December 21st. And that brings to mind a wise comment from actor-writer Steve Martin, and I quote, "A day without sunshine is like, you know, night." Well, if you're one of those Michiganders whose mood slides downhill as we slide into winter, or you get sleepy all the time, you have lots of company. And it's all tied to the relationship among light, mood, and melatonin. Let's talk more about seasonal affective disorder as we say hello to Asa Janssen. She's with the Center for the History of Emotions at Queen Mary University of London. However, she joins us now from Sweden, where they certainly know a thing or two about long, dark winter nights. Welcome to Stateside, Asa.
Thank you, Cindy. Thanks for having me.
Is it only a scant 31 years ago that the term seasonal affective disorder was actually unveiled?
Yes. So it's, as far as psychiatric disorders go, it's a very recent one. It hasn't been around for that long. However, people have, you know, for much longer felt sad and depressed in winter. But as a medical disorder, it's a very new one. It has a very short history.
It was a research paper by a South African psychiatrist, right, Dr. Norman Rosenthal. How did he put these pieces of this jigsaw together into a real syndrome with a real name and a real treatment?
Well, it's a fascinating history, really, especially as far as psychiatric disorders go. It's has a very unique history. So Norman Rosenthal, he came from South Africa originally and moved to New York in the 1970s. Well, he discovered, as you know, as winter came along and the days got shorter and colder, both him and his wife discovered that they felt depressed and lethargic, found it difficult to do their work and so on. Around this time, he met someone who was doing research on sort of sleep patterns and melatonin and mood, Alfred Louis, who's with the National Institute for Health in the US. And they started talking and found that they had quite a lot in common and sort of started off on this research. You know, is there actually some sort of correlation between people feeling depressed, actually having sort of an emotional disorder in winter, and the lack of light? And they advertised in a local paper to get people for their study and so on. And it sort of continued. They experimented with bright light as a treatment. It was a disorder that was very much researched in the laboratory from the start, which is very unusual for psychiatric disorders. And also the fact that the psychiatrists involved were quite active also as subjects, sort of, measuring their own melatonin levels. It's a sort of self-experiment that, some historians would recognize from the early modern period.
Also, what is at stake in putting a label, identifying seasonal affective disorder as a disorder? Why do we need to label it a disorder in the first place? I'm wondering, does it create a stigma?
Well, I mean, that's a very good question. I think there's a lot at stake, well, in naming any emotional or behavioral pattern as a disorder, as you suggest. But there are both positive and negative aspects. I mean, the positives are, of course, that by naming disorders in psychiatry, as in any branch of medicine, we can hopefully find the correct treatment to help someone feel better. However, in the case of SAD, that's also been a little problematic because the treatment that seems to really work and that's been part of the research from the beginning is light therapy, which, as one of the scientists who have been involved have suggested himself, light can't really be patented. There isn't an awful lot of money to make from it. So that's been a bit of a problem in terms of people accessing the treatment. It's not something that pharmaceutical companies want to really spend a lot of money researching since they can't patent it. But still, there are positives with naming a disorder in this way, in the sense that people can, get an understanding, perhaps feel that they can get an understanding of what's wrong with them, get some medical recognition and hopefully treatment. However, one might ask, do we actually need to call something a disorder in order for someone to get help?
Yes.
Of course, there is the issue of stigma, as you mentioned, although perhaps that's partly a problem with the attitude we have in general in society towards psychiatry and towards mental suffering. But, one of the things that historians of emotions and medicine do tend to look at is specifically this, how did we come to this point where we diagnose unpleasant feelings as illnesses? Because it hasn't always been like that, not in the sense that it is today. And I think there may be certainly be a danger, not just in terms of stigma, but also in terms of flexibility of treatment and treatment options. So if we call something a disorder, we say that it's medical, it then requires a medical treatment. But different things might work for different people. And perhaps, one might argue that you should be able to access whatever help and support you need, regardless of whether you have a medical label.
You know, it strikes me that when you think of other mood disorders that are commonly known and experienced, let's say generalized anxiety disorder or depression, it strikes me that those are kind of internal causes, where seasonal affective disorder is more externally caused. Does that make it tend to be taken less seriously, if you know what I mean?
Perhaps yes and no. I mean, the very idea that depression and anxiety are internal disorders is something that sort of that hasn't always been the prevailing view. With depression, it's gone back and forth a little bit. So in the mid-20th century, sort of more social explanations were quite popular, or psychosocial, I suppose you could call them. Whereas in the 19th century, biological explanations were quite popular, and again, they are now today. To be honest, I mean, it's a difficult question, actually. It's why I don't really know how to answer it, because I'm not quite sure. I mean, to be perfectly honest, I think that the fact that it has a scientific basis should, regardless of the etiology, so regardless of how we think that the illness comes about, should make it more plausible, more legitimate in a sense. However, in the current climate, where we do very much talk about mental disorders as internal, where we don't really take the sort of the environment into account as much as we did, say, 30, 40 years ago, perhaps, that is no longer the case. So indeed, I think you might be onto something. I think that might certainly be the case that because, we all suffer through winter, don't we? Why do some people suffer worse than others? It could be seen as potentially as a sign of weakness. So, but I don't know, it's difficult. I mean, it has a lot to do with, how we, society at present and medicine in general, views psychiatric and specifically emotional disorders. And that's something that's changed so much throughout time. And I'm sure it's going to continue to change.
Asa, as someone who has gotten her PhD studying the history of psychiatry, the history of emotions, what role do you think that SAD plays in the larger picture of human disorders?
Wow, that's quite a question. I think there's a lot of positives to be learned from it, from the history of this disorder. One is the fact that, as I mentioned earlier, psychiatrists who were involved in the research from day one had a very sort of open-minded approach to it and also participated themselves to some extent as subjects, measuring low melatonin levels and so on. And indeed, it was the fact that Norman Rosenthal first experienced sort of winter depression when he moved to New York that got him interested in the disorder. Also, patients have been very active in the process as well from the start. And that's also quite unusual. Unusual in the sense that patients have been active with a lot of agency, not just as sort of subjects or as, psychiatrists diagnosing them and saying, this is what you have. So in the UK, for example, there's a patient advocacy group called SADA, Seasonal Affective Disorder Association, who've been instrumental in trying to bring about more awareness within the psychiatric community and the medical community in the UK about this disorder, about access to treatment and so on. In that sense, I suppose it's a modern or almost postmodern disorder in many ways. Both the slightly different role of psychiatrists and scientists in the shaping of this disorder and the very active sort of positive role of patients, if you like, means that there's certainly lessons to learn, I think, for psychiatry in general, and specifically in regards to the patients who are given the label actually actively participating in shaping treatment and research.
Asa Janssen is with the Center for the History of Emotions at Queen Mary University of London, and she is working right now in Sweden. It was very interesting getting the merits of all of your study, Asa. Thank you so much for being with us on Stateside.
Thank you for having me, Cindy.
Today, Stateside was directed by Allie Billings. Our executive producer is Zoe Clark. Contributors are Cass Adair, Mike Blank, Emily Fox, Ryan Grimes, Sean McHenry, Mercedes Mejia, and Shelley Smith. Joe Lindstroth is producer of The Next Idea. Stateside's a production of Michigan Radio, a broadcasting service of the University of Michigan. I'm Cynthia Canty. Thank you so much for listening.
Support for The Next Idea on Stateside comes from Michigan Economic Development Corporation, committed to marketing Michigan to drive job growth and investment in our communities. MichiganBusiness.org.